KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, we talk with writer Layla Lalami about her new book, The Other Americans. It's a novel about a man who is struck and killed by a speeding car in a small town in the Mojave Desert, and it quickly becomes clear that his death is no accident. The man is a Moroccan immigrant, and so is Lalami. We'll talk with her about writing a modern-day murder mystery and love story involving immigrant characters against the backdrop of our nation's fierce debate on immigration. Join us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. I'm joined by writer Layla Lalami, whose new novel tells the story of nine different people who are all connected by the hit-and-run killing of a man named Driss Garawi. There's Driss's daughter. There's also an Iraq War vet, the detective in charge of the case, an undocumented immigrant who witnesses the hit-and-run but is afraid to go to police, and even Driss himself takes a turn as the narrator. He's a Moroccan immigrant who owns a diner in a small Mojave Desert town. As they take turns narrating the story, they tell a story of strained family ties, new love, fear of deportation, and dislocation. Layla Lalami is the author of three other novels, including the Pulitzer Prize finalist The Moors Account. Her essays and opinion pieces have also appeared in several major newspapers. Layla Lalami, welcome back to Forum.
Thank you for having me.
So one of the reasons I was compelled to read your novel was because of the way you described immigration in an interview as a natural, ordinary human experience that many of us have. And that felt so far away from the way I feel like immigration is discussed now. I mean, to bring up immigration or immigrants is to invoke very strong emotions, sometimes of anger or resentment, or the opposite of sympathy. You have language like invasion and children being ripped from parents, and you have people politically digging in their heels all around this one concept of immigration. So it was very interesting to hear you say, yeah, it's really an experience so many of us have and have had.
I think it's because if you look at it historically, it has always happened. It is a fact of human existence on this planet that whenever the conditions that make it possible for us to thrive cease to obtain, we pick up and move somewhere where we can thrive. And that has always been the case with human beings. And I think that's why when you look at some of the oldest stories that we tell ourselves, even if you look at biblical stories or if you look at literary stories, they're stories of displacement. They're stories of exile, of moving from one place and having to pick up and start over in another place. And so that's why I say it's ordinary, particularly because, for example, in America, we have 40 million immigrants. If you count documented people, undocumented people, naturalized citizens, that's quite a large immigrant population. But if you look at what's happening in the way in which we hear about it in the media, it's dominated by things like, quote unquote, the border crisis, or, you know, immigrants stealing jobs or various bad hombres. So it's really presented in these sort of exceptional terms, and it's presented as something that's dangerous when in fact it really is an ordinary human experience.
And you yourself are an immigrant as well. How do you think that the way that it's presented has affected the way that immigrants of all these different experiences feel themselves moving through the U.S. now, or feel like they're being perceived?
Well, so I became an immigrant by chance. I came to this country to go to graduate school, and then a couple of years later, I met somebody, and then we married, and now I'm an immigrant. I think the danger about these portrayals is that they encourage looking at immigration as a law enforcement issue. So because there's this whole focus about danger and I don't know, rapists and criminals crossing the border, it starts to be addressed as a law enforcement issue when in fact it is, among many other things, a labor issue, a humanitarian issue. It could just, as I said, an ordinary issue. So it's a combination of many things. It's not just the one thing. And I think because of those portrayals, it can lead us to look at it as a law enforcement problem to be solved.
Yes. And I felt like in reading your book, where you had 9 different characters narrating the story, the other Americans, that while some of the characters are immigrants, not all of them are. And not only that, but their immigration status is at times very central to their experience in America and other times completely incidental to their experience. Mm-hmm. And it made me think that you were trying to show the incidental nature of it to some degree to be able to put the person before their label as immigrant.
Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely right. So in the story obviously centers around the death of this Moroccan immigrant who's a business owner, and he dies on the first page, and it's a hit and run, and you don't know if it's an accident or a crime. But in writing about it and in writing about his family, it really opened up for me the possibility of looking at different ways in which the one decision to immigrate can have ripple effects, not only on the immigrant's life, but on the family, on the children, even on the person, for example, his children who were born here. So the effect of that decision that he made 35 years ago to move to America continues to happen today, if that makes sense.
And I'd like to ask you to read a little bit from your book. You've chosen an excerpt from one of the characters. Can you tell us which one you've chosen and why?
So this is told from the point of view of Mariam, who is Driss's wife, and I suppose now she would be his widow. And in this chapter, she's in the car driving home, and it's on that night that her husband is killed, but she doesn't know yet. And she's listening to a talk show, an advice show, and she's reminiscing about the moment that they moved to the United States. When we moved to America 35 years ago, many things took me by surprise, like gun shops next to barber shops, freeways that tangled like yarn, people who knocked on your door to talk about Jesus, 20 different kinds of milk at the grocery store, signs that said, "Don't even think about parking here." I remember pointing them out to Driss. They even have signs that tell you what you can't think. But above all, I was surprised by the talk shows, the way Americans loved to confess on television. Men talked about their affairs or addictions or gambling problems. Women talked about their weight or plastic surgeries or the children they had outside marriage. Even teenagers had something to say, mostly about how terrible their parents were. And all of it, like it was a normal thing. I couldn't stop watching. The television sat on top of the supply cabinet in the back of the donut shop, and while I was washing dishes or mopping floors, I would watch Sally or Donahue, which in those days were on in the middle of the afternoon when the shop was quiet. My brother had told me that watching television would help me improve my English, and I will say I learned a lot of new words like paternity test and artificial insemination and AIDS epidemic. But my trouble was pronunciation, how easy it was to say tree when I meant three, or utter when I meant other. I needed a lot of practice.
And that's Leila Lalami reading from her novel, The Other Americans, about a hit-and-run killing of a Moroccan immigrant named Driss Gerawi. And you've just read a passage from his wife, Mariam. Is the experience that she's describing of seeing these ways that Americans are engaging both on television and also coming to her door, is this something you experienced?
I mean, I remember actually coming to the United States and you know, turning on the television, and this was the heyday of all the talk shows and, you know, Oprah, and everybody was talking about themselves. And it was, for me, coming, so I was born and raised in Morocco, and I think that the divide between private and public self is a little bit different in that culture versus American culture. And so here with talk shows, it just seemed like people were basically talking about extremely private things on television. And I thought, you know, I could use that for this character. I could use, you know, the sort of gun culture, which is completely absent in Morocco, and have it in here. So it basically deals with that sort of culture shock when she first arrives. And of course, she adapts, and she's been here 35 years. And so in this chapter, she's basically just reminiscing about that initial shock.
And she is one, as I mentioned, of nine different narrators of this book. So first of all, what made you want to write a novel that would have nine different narrators around this killing, including Driss's daughter, his daughter's old high school classmate who is an Iraq War veteran, you know, the detective in the case, all the way to the neighbor of his restaurant who owns a bowling alley?
Well, it really started out just wanting to write a story about the death of a father. In 2014, while I was on vacation in Wyoming, I received a text from my sister telling me that my father had taken ill in Morocco and was in hospital and basically might not make it. And so we had to pack up and, you know, in a panic, fly to Morocco thinking that this was it. And very fortunately, thanks to the miracles of modern medicine, he recovered and he's completely fine. But when I came back, I really brought home that fear with me, and it made me realize that it's something that I share with millions of other people in the United States, this fear that they're going to be away from their loved ones in another country at the moment that those people are going to need them. And so the inspiration for the book was just to write about that fear. And of course, grief being this sort of complicated emotion is not, it's not one, it doesn't have a single texture. It comes in waves. And it was something that I wanted to explore, just to explore a thing that scared me the most. And in writing it, I wrote it from the perspective of Nora, the daughter who returns home. And
she was in Oakland when she gets a text saying that something has happened to her dad.
Yeah. And so, and then I included the detective because I wanted, in writing this story, I wanted the death to be a mystery. And so, of course, I needed to have a detective so that we can hear about the case. And then I had the sort of childhood friend / you know, love interest, because I insist on the necessity of love. And so I wrote a couple of drafts like that, but I think I was really having trouble moving the story forward. And so it took me a long time. And really, I have to credit my editor here, who asked me about honoring sort of these other characters that were in the story. Because when he asked that question, that's when it really opened up the narrative for me. And I realized that by opening it up to other perspectives, I would be able to use the same event, but then tell it from different points of view, not so much to create doubt about what really happened, but to put that single event in different contexts for different people. So, for example, with the detective, this is just her work. This is just the case that she gets assigned on Tuesday morning. She has her own concerns, her own life, her own family that she's worrying about. And she herself has moved from Washington, D.C. to this tiny little desert town. And that's a form of dislocation. That's a form of migration. That's a form that involves culture shock for her, too, because she's used to this big town. And then, you know, she's a very accomplished detective. And now she's investigating a hit and run in a tiny little town. So, you know, it really opened up a way to take the same event and explore it and look at, in a way, look at migration from many different perspectives.
Yes, by doing that, you could see how much these characters had in common, whether they were immigrants or not, whether they were legal immigrants or undocumented immigrants, or even whether they were the children of immigrants, the commonalities of experiences. But at the same time, you were also able to show how yet they have all of these walls between them and divisions between them because of the way that they are either perceived or because of their sense of not belonging as well. Who was the hardest character to inhabit when you were writing?
Oh, I would say the neighbor and his son were probably a bit more difficult for me to write because they're not very sympathetic characters. They're characters that whose politics I don't share, whose views on the world I don't share. And I had to write them with as much compassion and generosity as I had with all of the other characters. And that, I mean, this is the job description of the writer. It is that you have to have that imaginative empathy. You have to transport yourself or teleport yourself into the consciousness of this other individual that you might not share much with. And then you have to inhabit it. and make it real on the page. And so it was a bit more of a challenge, and I would say it was a little bit harder.
What did
but
you
I really
learn
enjoyed it.
From that experience of occupying somebody whose politics, occupying someone in the first person mm-hmm. whose politics mm-hmm. you don't agree with?
Well, I think exactly what you said, because it's in the first person, I realized that regardless of whether I approve or agree with people, when they narrate their own lives in the first person, they're using the voice that's maximally empathetic. Nobody comes out and says, oh, I'm a terrible person and I deserve everything terrible thing to happen to me. It's more of like, this is why I am the way I am. It's because of these circumstances, the sum of our private experiences. And so the first person really afforded me that possibility of understanding, which is not the same thing as approving, understanding this character.
When you wrote all these different characters and tried to give voice to these different perspectives, did you have a purpose or a goal of trying to make more nuanced our understanding of what it means to be an immigrant? Was that a specific goal, or did it just emerge as you were writing?
Not at all. In fact, I didn't even realize that immigration was a unifying theme of the book until I was probably, after I had decided to open it up to the 9 characters, I must have been 3 or 4 drafts into that before I started reading. What am I doing here? Why did I choose to make this detective a person who moves, who's new to town? And it just, I realized that it happened organically. And I think on some sort of subconscious level, because I think so much about immigration, that I had woven it into the backgrounds of many of the characters. And once I realized that, I decided to lean into it and actually use it in the book.
We're talking with Leila Lalami about her new novel, The Other Americans, about the hit-and-run death of a Moroccan immigrant in Southern California, actually in a small town in the Mojave Desert. The book is a murder mystery, a love story, a story about family, and through its telling reflects the experiences of being an immigrant in the United States, but also just the experiences of being somebody who moves from one environment to another, of dislocation. What are your questions and reactions as you are hearing Leila Lalami talk about writing this book and about the messages that immigrants get, but also the way that they're perceived and often how they're mixed? What is your immigration story? You can share it at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, at our website, kqed.org/forum, on Facebook, on Twitter, at KQED Forum, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. In terms of characters, Leila Lalami, it feels like the desert, in some ways, is another character. The sparseness, it's very desolate, but at the same time, there's so much going on beneath the surface. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Absolutely. I mean, I was born and raised in Rabat, which is the capital of Morocco. It's a big city. And then I've lived in London, another big city. And now I live in L.A., a huge city. So I've always thought of myself as like a sort of a big city person. But much to my surprise, about 8 or 9 years ago, my husband and I started going out to the desert very regularly. And I was stunned by how much it spoke to me. And I think it's the wide open spaces, the complete silence, and the fact that you have to look beneath the surface to see the life that is actually thriving there. It looks, because it's the desert, it looks like it's dead, but actually it's thrumming with life. And I love that. And that's something that I wanted to use in the book, something that requires you to look beneath the surface, I suppose. And so I very much enjoyed writing about the landscape in this novel.
And you also set it in the present day. This is the first of your 4 novels that is set in the present day. I mean, the Moore's account, that was set in the 1500s.
Yes.
And was told from the perspective of somebody on a slave ship.
Correct.
What made you want to set this in the present day?
Well, precisely the fact that the previous book was a historical novel and had required 5 years of writing and research. And at the end of it, I was very tired. And I thought, you know, I would like to take a break from writing about history. And so I'm going to write something that's set in the here and the now. And that's when the idea for this book came about, as I mentioned earlier, with the fact that my dad had taken ill. I think with each of my books, there's some kind of a connection to this location. So the first 2 were set in Morocco, and then these 2 are set in America. And obviously, in the 16th century, there was no United States. But in some sense, it's as if this whole like story of this location is coming closer and closer to me in my here and my now.
Dislocation. It's interesting that you use that word more often than you would migration mm-hmm. or immigration. Mm-hmm. One of the essays that you have written has talked about how dislocation will become more of a norm under climate change. And that we as a society need to think about how we are going to address dislocation as it accelerates. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about your message around that, what it is that you want people to try to understand?
Well, it is to understand that if you are a native-born citizen of the United States, it's easy to think that immigration does not concern you because you are not yourself an immigrant. But climate change can make immigrants out of all of us, because unless we take really drastic action on it, with all of the extreme weather events that we're going to be seeing in the next few decades, people are going to be forced to move. And
yes,
where are they going to be forced to move? I mean, if you look at Paradise Fire, you know, it's not very far from here. An entire town has been destroyed. And not everyone's going to be able to rebuild in that area. Some people are going to move. And this has happened. This is already happening. So the question then becomes...
Yes, I mean, you have like 1.6 million people who are affected by Cyclone Idai in southern Africa.
Exactly.
Where are they gonna...
Exactly. So it's happening absolutely everywhere in the world, and it's going to accelerate, which is why dealing with climate change is such an urgent issue. It's going to lead to more migration. It's going to lead to more conflict. And therefore, we better figure out how we're going to deal with it. And so, as I said, you know, it's easy if you're a citizen to think that immigration doesn't affect you, but there is no single person in the United States who's not affected by it. Unless you're an indigenous person, you can trace your ancestry to an immigrant or a refugee in this country. So either you're an immigrant, your spouse is an immigrant, your parents are immigrants, your grandparents, and so on and so forth. And even if you can say, well, I've been here since the Mayflower, even so, immigration still affects you. It's in the device that you use every day. It's in the food that you eat every day. It's in the clothes that you wear every day. That's why I say it's an ordinary issue. It's not an extraordinary issue. And that really requires us to radically shift our priorities. So to give you just one small example, do we want to spend several billion dollars on a wall, for example, or to complete a pre-existing wall? Just to be clear about that, there are 700 miles of border wall already. But do we want to spend more money on something like that, which is not going to do anything about the underlying issue? Do we want to help countries like Guatemala or Honduras or El Salvador? Or do we want to shut the border to them? So these are questions that really need radical rethinking.
Well, do you have a response? I mean, do you have a way that you want us to rethink our approach to what you describe as the inevitable displacements that will take place in our lifetime, accelerated by climate change? And we are about to go into a break, so I'll let you think about that as we... And we'll go get back to it afterwards. We're talking with Leila Lalami, novelist, author of The Other Americans. And we're talking about immigration and migration and dislocation and also just the stories that bind us. The number 866-733-6786 to call if you'd like to join the conversation with your questions and thoughts. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with writer Leila Lalami about her new novel, The Other Americans, which opens with the hit-and-run killing of Driss Garawi, a Moroccan immigrant living in present-day Southern California. Nine narrators unfold the aftermath of Driss's story, each giving readers a different perspective. There's an Iraq War vet, the detective in charge of the case, Driss's daughter, an undocumented immigrant who witnesses the hit and run, and the aging owner of a bowling alley. The first-person accounts show how much the characters have in common, yet how divided they also remain from each other. And Leila Lalami, her essays and opinion pieces have appeared in the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, The Nation, The Guardian, the New York Times, and in many anthologies. She's also the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning finalist, The Moore's Account. To join the conversation, call us at 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, on Facebook, tweet us at KQED Forum, or email us at forum@kqed.org. Share your immigration stories. In an essay, Leila Lalami wrote once that America embraces her with one arm and pushes her away with another. Do you get mixed messages around immigration? What is someone you know, if you yourself are not an immigrant, how are they handling the way immigration is dealt with in this country? And just before the break, Leila Lalami, we were talking about rethinking our approach to displacement, because even as we are seeing more people coming to the border now, not historically the highest ever, but more people coming to the border now, you are saying that with world events and climate change, we are likely to see much more displacement in our lifetime. So what do we do about that? How do we go forward?
Well, basically to take action on the things that are pushing people to leave their homes. So the only reasons that there's basically two reasons why people end up coming to or moving to another country. There's either a push factor or a pull factor. Either they're being pushed because their circumstances, it's unsafe, or they're being pulled because they want to reunite with families in another country. So if people in this country don't want more immigrants showing up at their door, then they have to work to improve conditions elsewhere. You can't, on the one hand, say, well, let's help Saudi Arabia, for example, bomb Yemen, and let's help them refuel their jets midair. Let's contribute to this massive humanitarian crisis in Yemen. And on the other hand, say, nope, we can't take in any Yemeni immigrants because of the travel ban. So our entire way, the way in which these policies are drafted just does not make it possible for us to solve the immigration crisis.
So it sounds like you're saying have a global view to
Absolutely.
Some extent.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, let's go to Amy in Woodland. Hi, Amy.
Hi. See, I grew up in Oakland, and I graduated from Cal with a major in history, so I'm very interested in these kind of topics. But after I graduated from college, I moved to South Dakota, to the capital, which is very rural. And after 40 years of living in a small, very conservative town, I always felt like an expat, an outsider, no matter how hard I tried to understand and learn about the history, the geography, the culture of the people who immigrated there. I always connected with other people from other states and other countries. I never really have a really close friend from there that was a South Dakotan. So I understand that sense of not belonging somewhere, even if you're from the same country and you speak the same language. Yeah.
And what's your reaction to Amy's story? Leila,
I mean, I have to say I'm not surprised, because I think obviously as human beings, everybody is going to have a different reaction to being placed in a new environment. When you are placed in a new sort of landscape or a new town or a new city, I think in some sense it can affect your identity and contribute to identity formation or reformation. And I don't know how old you were when you moved to South Dakota. Were you an adult?
I was 23.
Yeah. So you had a pretty good sense of who you were as a person. And so then having to adapt to this new environment and hearing, you know, and adapt into this essentially a new microculture becomes that much harder at that age. I was 22 when I came to the United States. And I would say the difference is that the United States had already come to me in Morocco long before I moved to the United States. And so I think that might be a little bit different.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the United States, for example, you know, through its culture, through its movies, through its music, was familiar to me. It wasn't unfamiliar to me before I moved here. And I'd also majored in English, and I'd studied U.S. history. So it was a sense of familiarity. But even so, you know, even though I've been in this country for 20 years, there are certain things that still stand out to me. I mean, so I have a complete empathy for this listener. I understand what it's like to feel a little bit like in this place, but not of it. Like, I understand that very much.
Yes, and the character Nora you wrote, and I couldn't help but see the connection to you, but in the character Nora, Driss's daughter, she's talking about often being the one singled out for a random pat down at the airport.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Or, you know, inevitably, if you're at a party, somebody mentions how great it is that in your country people let you get educated. clearly, there are moments in the book, The Other Americans, where Nora has very similar interactions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and she's actually born here. She's born in the United States, so she's Driss's daughter. But even from a young age, she was made to feel, because of her name, for example, Nora's Hor Gerawi, because of the food she eats, because her parents are immigrants, she was made to feel othered at school. So it's an experience that she's carried with her as well, even though she's born here.
Yes, I find that so interesting that that you write about how even American-born children are truly in some ways immigrants or outsiders because they live with the ripple effects of their parents' decision to move to the United States.
Yeah. I think it's because we carry inside us sort of like the histories of our family. So within us, we carry those histories. And so if your father is this immigrant that came here, you somehow carry that with you. And I think people see that. And I think people also have a tendency to put others in sort of like different categories. And so any divergence from sort of like the white male mainstream is picked up and noticed and commented upon. And so I think that that's what she's facing when she's at school, her difference.
Well, I want to thank Amy for the call and also comment on how by including the experiences of children of immigrants, you are also expanding the universe of people that you feel like can relate to this experience, which in some ways also feels deliberate so that people can be more open and understanding about what it means. And I can certainly relate as the child of immigrants myself. And also, I am an immigrant to the United States, though from Canada. So it wasn't quite as dramatic as, say, for what my parents had to experience. But there certainly is a ripple effect. There certainly is an experience that shapes who you are, how you are perceived when your parents who are not from the U.S. decide to make it their home. Let's go next to Eunice in Oakland. Hi, Eunice.
Hi, salam alaikum alayla.
Alaikum salam.
I'm grateful to see Layla giving a very different narrative about the experience of immigrants. And, you know, I followed in Layla's path coming from Morocco. We went to the same university. We came here on a Fulbright. And my experience in the U.S. has been that when I first came in, the first 10 years of being here, I just felt I blended in and this was a great place to be. And then 9/11 happened. And then all of a sudden, the narrative around people that come, that share my background, that are Muslims and Arabs, has become so pronounced in this country. And all of a sudden, my experience of being here has changed. And I think what happens, and this is a very historical fact, is that political trends and economic trends tends to change the conversation and the narrative and the policy around the status of immigrants. And this is a very common thing we have seen across history. And the question that I want to ask Layla is around what, you know, Morocco is a gateway of immigration to Europe. And immigration usually happens from the south to the north, where there is the south, there is less, and then in the north, there is more opportunity. Mm-hmm. And Morocco really struggles with this issue of immigration, mm-hmm. of Africans coming up to Morocco to cross the Mediterranean into Europe. Mm-hmm. And Morocco has been in this middle crisis, mm-hmm. of trying to work out with the European Union a solution. But I would like Layla to really reflect on how we Moroccans or North Africans really deal with this immigration issue from the global south perspective rather than the north global perspective.
Eunice, thanks.
This is a really a great point. And I think what I like about this point is that it sort of broadens the idea of immigration, that it's not something that is happening to the United States alone. It's happening everywhere. One of the things that you hear, for example, from the president very frequently is how, you know, we're being invaded, quote unquote, and how we can't take in more immigrants and so on and so forth. And of course, the United States, the rate of the number of people who are coming here is not as high as in many other parts of the world. So it's actually kind of a misconception that we're taking in more immigrants than other countries.
Right. But our systems have not been designed to take in the, or at least we're not implementing our systems in a way that make it possible for that to be a smooth process.
Right, for sure. And so what's happening is that actually other countries are facing the exact same issues. The United States is not alone in this. Migration is happening everywhere around the world. And in the case of Morocco, there are migrants that come from different parts of Africa because they're trying to cross and to get to Europe. And many of them don't make it and end up staying in Morocco. So Morocco has become not just a transition point, but also a host country. And I have to say, I'm sorry to say, is woefully unprepared for that. And it has really sort of given rise to and really revealed sort of the underlying racism within Moroccan society towards people who are from other parts of Africa. So it's been, I think one of the things that reveals is that it's actually something else that binds all of us, is this fear of the other, the fear of the person who's coming from another place. And so we look for ways to say, oh, they're different from me because fill in the blank. It could be the color of the skin, could be a different religion, could be a different anything. And so Morocco's not dealing with it very well. In a way, it very much parallels what's happening with Mexico, where people are coming from the Northern Triangle to Mexico and staying there. And Mexico then is being threatened by the president to deal with it. And they're just in the middle. They're stuck in the middle. And that's kind of the situation Morocco is in as well.
Well, let me go next to Goli in Berkeley. Hi, Goli.
Hi. I'm really enjoying this conversation, and I just wanted to add that I'm from Iran, and I've been in the United States for 4 years. I came when I was 13, so I completely believe that, you know, where you're coming from and your culture is very, very important in how you think and who you are. And I still don't feel completely at home, but I don't know where home is. And I've come to really appreciate that where people are coming from is really unimportant. What's important is people, you know, what they value. And I think I gained a new perspective on my own state of immigration by meeting my husband and his family, who are through and through Americans. Mm-hmm. You know, they came with Mayflower, but they feel out of place in the United States because I think there's so many different conflicts and, you know, different conflicting set of values that I think when we feel at home, it's when we feel like we can connect with the values that other people around us have, or at least we can talk about it. And I think that's really important to emphasize, because all this emphasis on identity, as much as it is important, I think it takes away from our focus on what do we value and how can we talk about those values.
That's interesting.
Nicole, thank you.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And one of the things I appreciate about this listener's perspective is this idea that that what we think of as home changes. If you were born in a place and you live in that place and you never leave that place, and somebody says, where is home? You can say right here, right? It's both a physical space, but it can be like a space in the mind. But when you migrate, I think that one-to-one relationship becomes much more complicated. So speaking for myself, for example, when people ask me about home, I always say it's my husband, my family, it's the people who love me that I love. But in terms of a place, that becomes a bit more of it becomes more complicated. Do you say, well, I was actually born and raised in Morocco and now I live in Los Angeles? Is it these two places? So it really has detached the idea of home for me from a physical space to more of an emotional space. And I think with this listener, what this person is saying is that it's also a value space for her, is what I'm hearing from how she's describing it.
I'm struck. So you do have children and you are an immigrant. You moved here and you write about your... You're clearly aware of that effect on children. Do you wrestle with that in terms of your own decision to be here?
I do. And I think that's part of the reason why this character, Nora, is born here. Because, you know, when you're in your 20s and you're in love and you get married and you're not thinking about the consequences of committing to being an immigrant in this new country, you're just with the person that you love. And then, you know, years pass and then you start a family and then sort of the consequences of that decision start to settle in.
Such as?
For example, the fact that my child is growing up without a daily exposure to grandparents, aunts and uncles, without a reservoir of family stories that are accompanying her on her journey through life. Without, I mean, it can be something as simple as like, every time there's a school performance, you know, somebody can show up with, you know, 15 family members. And then in my child's case, it's not like that, you know. So that sense of loss that I committed to has been passed down to her, if you will. And that's what I mean by that.
Hmm. Let's talk next with Jeff in Sebastopol. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, good morning. I wanted to reflect on the push. You know, for example, I'm getting a little feedback, so I'm sorry about that. But my mother ended up in the United States from Nazi Germany in 1939, so she was pushed here. My cousin-in-law, he was pulled here from Mexico. And when we sit down and we talk about immigration, even though he was going to Mexico, he doesn't really have that much sympathy for, you know, all cases of immigration. And I think one of the factors that contributes to that is language and assimilation. Mm-hmm. One thing that makes people different is if they become insular and don't become part of the community within which they enter. So, for example, my mom, she came to the United States. She cut high school a lot. She went to the movies, so she has a Hollywood accent. And my cousin-in-law, you know, he made a supreme effort to learn English, and he's a very successful businessman. And I think it holds immigrants back when they don't assimilate. I know that could be a politically correct, you know, football. But at the same time, if you want to look at individual cases, when people do assimilate, they have a greater chance of success because they blend in.
Jeff, it's an interesting.
They have to lose their identity. That just means that's an avenue for success.
Jeff, thanks for the perspective. And if I could ask you, Jeff, as just a follow up. I guess one of the things that I wonder about is how well we understand the difficulty or the challenges in assimilation. It really varies, right, depending on the environment that you're in, Leila Lalami. That's a question that Jeff's point is making me think about. Is in some ways in your book, your characters really are striving to assimilate, but they experience very different degrees of challenge,
yeah,
in that in attaining that goal.
Well, I think the issue in talking about assimilation is that it's not very clearly defined and it means very different things to different people. Mm. So, for example, some people might say, oh, you know, learning English is key to assimilation. And certainly, you know, learning English and being fluent in it can open up many more job prospects than not speaking English. So that's a fact. It will open up opportunity. But is that enough then? When we then decide that this person has assimilated, or do we then go on and make more demands? Well, this person speaks English, but I don't quite like the way that they're dressed, or I don't like the fact that they cover their hair, or I don't like the fact that they, you know, dress a certain way. You know, assimilation has never really been clearly defined. And historically, it's actually not true at all that new waves of immigrants gave up their languages and learned English. Entire towns in the United States spoke German or spoke Danish and didn't necessarily switch to English. So language is maybe a part of it, but not all of it. The other thing, too, that I would invite the listener to consider is the role of power in assimilation. So, for example, when you look historically at the United States, the indigenous people in this country did not ask the newcomers that came here to assimilate to them. It was actually the contrary. It was indigenous people that were forcibly and sometimes brutally assimilated into mainstream culture. Their children were taken from them. They were forbidden to wear their hair in native styles. They had to speak the English. They had to, you know, give up parts of their ancestral beliefs. They had, you know, so assimilation can be actually kind of a brutal process. And so I think one thing that really requires a bit more thought is, like, what do we mean by assimilation, and why are we making these demands, and what would constitute sufficient assimilation? So if you look at the main characters in this book, the family that came from Morocco, the father has a successful business, and the one of the daughters is born here. The older daughter that's born in Morocco is a dentist. So in terms of superficial judgments, you might say this is a successful family, it's assimilated. And yet the book opens with this mystery, which is that this man has been killed in a hit and run, and it is a suspicious hit and run. Is it a crime? What is the intention and all of that? So assimilation is kind of a two-way street. It's not enough to say the immigrants have to assimilate. Is the native person also satisfied with that immigration, or do they continue raising the bar, removing the goalposts and all of that? So,
well, let me thank Jeff for prompting an interesting conversation about that. And Olivia writes, how much of the way you write is reflective of you as a person? How emotionally attached do you get to your characters? I've also wondered how authors financially survive when I hear how long it takes to write a typical novel.
That is a very good question. I think oftentimes, well, so in terms of writing, the idea could come from anything. It can come from a conversation with a stranger in an airport lounge. It can come from something I see in a museum. It can come from something I read in a newspaper, or it can come from my own experiences. So, for example, with this book that starts out with the death of a father, I mentioned earlier that I wrote it because I was afraid that my father was going to die, or, you know, we're all going to die, but I was afraid that of what the experience would mean and how I would live it. So that was what inspired it. But that was just the starting point, and then imagination takes over. Another example of that in the book is that I suffer from insomnia, and have for a few years. And I thought, why should I suffer alone? I'm going to saddle a character with this. Okay, but then why does he suffer from insomnia? What's keeping him up at night? And that gets me thinking and opens up avenues for creating this character. So sometimes the personal experience or the random conversation can be, or the piece of art or whatever it is, can be a starting point, but then imagination sort of takes over. And then in terms of supporting myself as a writer, this is a very good question, because a lot of people, you know, I mean, it can take years to finish a book. And even if you finish it, there is no guarantee that it's going to sell to a publisher. Even if it sells to a publisher, there's no guarantee that they're going to pay you enough to live on. So I highly recommend having a full-time job outside of writing, at least initially. And I teach creative writing. I'm a professor at the University of California. So that is how I support myself. That's why I can afford to take 4 years to write a book, 5 years.
Well, let's next go to Ebru in Mountain View. Am I saying your name correctly?
Hi. Yes, you have.
Great. What's on your mind?
I wanted to say we have moved to the Bay Area about 24 years ago. And I think one of the reasons we do not feel as foreigners or out of place as we may have felt anywhere else in the world is probably because this area has a lot of immigrants. It has a big immigrant community. And when you share similar experiences, when you have more people sharing the similar backgrounds with you or similar experiences in this country, then you sort of find a new home. But then when I talk to other friends who may be in other areas of the country, coming from Turkey, my country, then sometimes they do express different feelings because they may be in a different community where immigrant numbers and immigrant community may not be as big. And then it becomes a question of identity for either side, because the community you're trying to now belong to is questioning, who are these people? Are they going to be assimilating well enough or adapting well enough into our community, or are they going to try and change us? And on the side of the immigrants, it becomes a question of, we do want to hold on to our traditions and cultures, yet we now have a new home, and we also want to belong here. Well, so it is, for us, it hasn't been that big of a struggle, but I do hear it is not always easy.
Well, glad to hear it, Ebru. I want to just fit in this other story from a listener. She writes, my father at 12 years old emigrated from Greece in the 1950s with his father. My grandfather was murdered in the hospital where he worked after they arrived. Oh, it was a terrible tragedy, and my father was essentially orphaned. But the family's response almost to this day was to cover it up, not talk about it. Until recently, I was under the impression he died of a heart attack.
Oh, my goodness.
This silence around certain experiences, it almost feels like it's so reflected in just this whole story and the immigrant who didn't want to come forward and share what he witnessed.
Yeah, I mean, I think because of the sort of mythology of this country, that this is a country where that is, you know, so we are told, built by immigrants. Of course, that's something that should be unpacked. It was obviously built by many people, including enslaved people primarily and immigrants. And so there's this mythology that, you know, the American dream, everybody can come here and make it. It doesn't matter where you come from. Here, everybody can make it. And I think that mythology is so powerful that when you have a life story like this person that you've just read that includes something that's less savory or that's more tragic or that might reflect poorly, I think people don't necessarily want to talk about it because that mythology is so seductive that we kind of all of us fall under its sway.
Well, Leila Lalami, thank you so much for coming in today to talk about your book, The Other Americans. It's a novel. It's the story of a Moroccan immigrant who is killed in a hit-and-run death in Southern California. And it's got a lot to it, love, murder, and family. So thank you for talking with us today about it and also about your immigration experience. And thanks to our listeners for sharing their immigration stories as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Mina Kim. You've been listening to Forum. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.